Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 26th of April 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we are delighted to be joined today by live video Skype link by Alex Thompson of Eastern Approaches. And of course, Alex will be talking to us from his base in the Netherlands. Before we start the news today, I think just a warning that the first slide may upset some.
Yes.
Offend people, those of a weak disposition, so if in doubt, turn away.
Here we go. Is he or is he not going to be the face of the general election? This is a discussion that the Tories are having, and the mainstream media coverage over the last day or two has been quite amusing. So it began with Theresa May set to make Boris Johnson the main face of the Tory campaign in a bid to woo Labour leavers. And then it became battle over Boris poll roll. PM faces cabinet calls to hide toxic foreign secretary, but vows to send him into the fray. And today it's three cabinet sources have told Sky News that Mr. Johnson was not on the core team of campaign figureheads, suggesting that the gaffe-prone foreign secretary will be used sparingly on the national airwaves as Team May looks to tightly control the message and avoid any slip-ups. Well, I would say if he keeps his seat, that would be a travesty of justice. I am labelling this man a war criminal now based on the fact that he has funded organisations and people that are or that could be shown to have been involved in murdering children. And I don't think that's too hard a thing to say, Brian.
No. And of course, the message we are putting out, the message put out very strongly by the British Constitution Group, is we now have a window of opportunity. MPs away from that protective environment of Parliament. They've got to be out campaigning. Now is the time for people to really challenge them with the reality of what they've been up to. So whether it's to do with war, children or the banks, it's time for people to really get in the faces of these MPs in, of course, a polite, well-measured way, because that wins wider support. But to put in front of them the questions they don't want to be asked.
Alex, do you think I'm being a bit too harsh in describing Boris Johnson as a war criminal?
Well, ultimately, Mike, it's, of course, up to international law to make that decision. But I don't think it's harsh of you to draw preliminary conclusions. We could be very technical and say prima facie. He looks like a war criminal because he's headed the Foreign Office, which has funded some of the worst people in on the ground in Iraq and Syria. And in fact, throughout a number of African countries. International law, of course, is a slow grinding wheel. And much of the law is customary rather than based explicitly on paper. So we'll have to see what is made of that in the future. But ultimately, it's up to an international or indeed a British court to try him for his apparent war crimes.
Okay, well, let's stick with the election. And Spiked here suggesting now give us a referendum on the House of Lords. Now, of course, this has been a long-standing sort of theme throughout the constitutional reformists. Over the last couple of number of years, in fact, we're told that the House of Lords, an unelected body, these people have no right to have a say on anything that goes on in Parliament. And the article here saying is Theresa May called out for those who seem intent on impeding Brexit during her snap general election announcement. There was a striking inclusion alongside the pro-EU predictables of the SNP and the Lib Dems, namely the unelected members of the House of Lords who have vowed to fight Brexit every step of the way. I'm not certain that's true, Alex, but at the end of the day here, what we've got is a misunderstanding amongst the general public about the role of the House of Lords, about our constitutional settlement and what their job actually is.
Absolutely, Mike. It's clearer where countries have an upper house of parliament, which is called the Senate. We're going to get onto the Russian Senate later, and it's called the Federation Council, which makes it even clearer. The House of Lords is a council of those who represent the nation in a different sense than the lower house of parliament does. In the US, of course, you've got the House of Representatives appointed by geographical constituencies, and the senators in the model which was followed till the 1930s, drawn from the states by indirect election, by appointment. That's still the model that the Dutch upper house uses, and in fact, the Russian Senate, the French Senate, that's how senates operate in aping of the British House of Lords in many cases. We got there first with the right customary and constitutional solution. If you have two houses elected directly by the people, they're just going to reinforce each other, and you're going to have we could say a slide towards tyranny in mono will become a slide towards tyranny in stereo. But if you've got the House of Lords consisting of people whose expertise is the interests of the land geographically or of certain social classes with deep insights, then you have a check and balance on the absolute abuse of power.
Absolutely. And of course, the even worse situation with an elected House of Lords comes whips, and we end up with two chambers which are there to represent party interests or corporate interests, but not the interests of individuals.
This is quite something that we've been finding in the Holly Gregg case, where Robert Greene continues to do what he can within legal threats made towards him. And he's recently found that some of the baronesses who have been causing him trouble or not responding properly are the equivalent in the Lords of whips in the Commons. Of course, everything in the Lords has to be dignified and pretend to be higher than the Commons, even though it's now being stuffed with Commons has-beens. And so instead of having whips in the House of Lords, they have Lords and Baronesses in waiting. But it amounts to much the same thing, a party system which was never designed for the Commons and which in the Lords is completely fatal.
Yeah, OK, well, look, let's move on then to Netherlands and... Who's this gentleman, just before we show this little clip?
This is Thierry Baudet, which is T-H-I-E-R-R-Y, and his surname is B-A-U-D-E-T. And he represents a party newly formed called the Forum for Democracy, which has gained two of the 150 seats in Parliament. And he's a sharp young mind and an author. And his number two on the party list, who's in Parliament here as well now, is an old and refined lawyer. And together they take their surgical minds and their Anglophilia, we could say, to the Dutch Parliament. And Baudet came to fame by leading a citizens' protest movement, which collected many signatures, insisting that the background to the adoption of the euro be introduced. And here he is taking Mr. Dijsselbloem to task, who, as well as being the Dutch finance minister, is the chairman of the euro group. In other words, he represents the interests of the European Central Bank to the European, to the euro currency member states. And he's calling this a ridiculous schizophrenia in this clip, while Dijsselbloem looks on with rolling eyes and humming and hawing. So finally, we have some, I was going to say UKIP style, but they're better than that, classic Democrats in the Dutch Parliament, whose slogan was very much vote for us to smash the party cartel, which is the mainstream parties all acting in collaboration. And by standing erect and having a proper posture and declamatory voice and saying you, sir, are the problem, and referring to political principles rather than party principles, Baudet is showing up that most of the other 150 MPs in the chamber are just stuffed shirts. It's a very effective maneuver, and it shows that serious opposition to the euro and the EU is beginning to be seen in Parliament across the European continent.
Okay, well, let's move on to Yemen now. And I mentioned this from Save the Children. This was a tweet they sent out yesterday. The world is abandoning Yemen's children. And they were complaining that it was only 14% of the $2.1 billion needed to save lives has been pledged. And I was pointing out that Save the Children Fund were saying nothing whatever about Saudi Arabia. Now, that tweet went out because yesterday the United Nations were holding a high-level, what they described as a high-level pledging event for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. And they are aiming to raise this $2.1 billion. They're calling it the Humanitarian Response Plan. They're looking for 106 humanitarian partners and so on. And the Secretary General of the United Nations was there, Mr. Guterres, and he was saying, you know, Yemen is facing a tragedy of immense proportions. He said, on average, a child under the age of five dies of preventable causes in Yemen every 10 minutes. This means 50 children in Yemen will die during today's conference. And all of those deaths could have been prevented. But he said nothing about Saudi Arabia. Nobody really said anything about Saudi Arabia in any of the reports that I saw. This is what I speculate. He said, shh, don't mention Saudi Arabia. They pledged $150 million after all. So it turns out that Saudi Arabia pledged $150 million. So they're bombing the hell out of the country. But that's all right, because they pledged $150 million towards humanitarian support. This is humanitarian support which the people, the campaigners who are on the ground in Yemen that were at this United Nations conference said could not get through. Of the others who pledged, 100 million came from Kuwait, 55 from Germany, 94 from the United States, 139 from the UK. So all this money has been pledged. Where's it going? What's it going to be used for? That is impossible to know. Alex, this situation continues to go on, but until we deal with the fact that Saudi Arabia is bombing the country, and we deal with the fact that Saudi Arabia is blockading the ports and airports, no humanitarian aid is going to get in. And even if it does, what's going to happen to it? It's going to be just like in Syria, when it's going to fall into the hands of the wrong types of people, and it's going to end up on the black market at highly inflated prices.
And she talks about non-governmental organisations there, and she has this very useful observation. She says non-governmental organisations are almost never non-government funded organisations. And she talks about how USAID basically handed over the franchise for Yemen to the King Salman Relief Fund, the Saudi Arabian outfit, just before the war. And they have a chokehold on relief in the country. As regards the money flows there, Mike, it's all Western money, isn't it? The Gulf states money, which they're using to buy people off and get themselves appointed to human rights positions in the UN, that's all from Western customers for their oil and other service industries. And Germany, US, British, Dutch, Swedish, Norwegian money going to questionable outfits in the Middle East, that's raised from taxpayers and from borrowing. So we're beggaring ourselves for this policy.
Absolutely. Let's move on to Eastern Europe then. Yeah, you wanted to highlight this. Russian, Armenian and Azerbaijani foreign ministers discuss Karabakh. What's in the works here?
We covered a year ago that there was a flare-up last spring in the Nagorno-Karabakh war, which is between Armenia and Azerbaijan, which is usually a conflict that's frozen. And it's monitored by the OSCE's Minsk group, which includes Russia but not Britain. Britain said it wasn't interested at the time. The French are in it. And then the Russian foreign minister, Lavrov, has suddenly called back for the first time in some while both of the foreign ministers of the combatant countries to sit around the table. This is not by chance. Just before the news, actually, I was having an exchange with David Ellis, and he said he predicted that Nagorno-Karabakh, the area between Armenia and Azerbaijan, was very likely to be where certain hotheads in NATO would want to cause spillover from the Middle East and Turkey issues at the moment and move them towards Russia. So I think there's a very good chance that the Russians have analysed this and have decided to prevent and preempt that by getting facts on the ground sorted. If Lavrov didn't do this bilaterally, the Armenians and Azeris will be left by the Western members of the Minsk group to fight it out. And because we're getting into wartime summer season now, we will be seeing a hot war on the ground before long, aided by Turkey, perhaps, on the Azeri side. So I think Lavrov is again checkmating that.
And in the meantime, Poland and the United States ratcheting up tension, as you've described it. So they're going to host a NATO command center on the eastern flank?
Yes, if you look at the map there, you can see that the yellow route, which is how you would sail in from the Baltic Sea to the Polish port of Elbląg, which is there in blue, spelled E-L-B-L-A-G in Latin script. If you sail in, you have to go around this great long spit of land. And halfway up that spit, as you can probably see the faint border, that's the split between the part of old German Prussia that went to Poland and the part that went to the Russian Federation. So north of that line is Russia. In other words, if Poles or craft from any nation want to sail into Elbląg, they currently have to do a dogleg into Russian waters up to Baltijsk and back down again. Now, the Polish government, although Elbląg is by no means a substantial port, has suddenly said we need to dig a channel, Suez-type channel, through this priceless spit of land with virgin pine forests and beautiful sandy beaches on it, and pollute the Vistula Lagoon, which is the inside water there, ostensibly for marine traffic so that we're not held to ransom by Russia. But look at the map there. West of that yellow line, you've got the massive built-up area on the side of that bay when it turns vertical and goes north. And that's the three cities of Gdansk, Gdynia and Sopot, which people will remember from the Solidarity protests. That is Poland's dockyards. All the naval stuff is there. I think you have on the following slide an indication of what is in Elbląg, otherwise I'll mention it.
No, just go ahead.
I will, yes. What's in Elbląg, and this was a point announced half a year ago, is the forward operating base for the four battalions, which are going to be, as of this month, well, that was the planning as of last year anyway, as of April 2017, they will be arriving, the US in the lead, you four American battalions in the city of Elbląg on the eastern side of that lagoon, to become, and NATO calls it this in its own language, the eastern flank of NATO. In other words, someone in the Pentagon has clicked their fingers and said, I don't care about that priceless spit of land. You'd damn well dig a tunnel, a channel through there, because we don't even want our battalions to have to take a train a few miles from one port to the other. We want to be able to sail them straight in, which is typical of the Pentagon, really, trashing the countries that it has its forward operating bases in. Also indicates something of what we've discussed before, Mike, where certainly you and I, which is the chauvinism and the nationalism gaining the upper hand in Poland, and to the extent that they're throwing away their priceless natural resources in the process.
F-35s allegedly landing in Estonia to keep pressure on there as well. But of course, the Russians must be laughing at that because the F-35 is not a functional platform as yet.
No, this is saber rattling. Sorry, it's an old hackneyed term, but it's very appropriate. The Estonians, of course, are well known for this. They're a great nation, but they've always had this habit of trying to use the West to fight their battles. And a lot of the current generation of political and strategic thinkers in Estonia are, in fact, the emigrants or the children of emigrants who were in North America until 1991. And so they've come back with neocon thinking, and part and parcel of that is using supposedly great American weaponry to frighten the Russians. The great discovery, which they still haven't made there in Estonia, in the ruling circles, is that Russia is no longer communist. However much they might have suffered under communism, and that is unspeakably much, Russia is the most anti-communist country I can think of in Russia at the moment, in Europe at the moment.
Just to keep the pressure on, of course, in Ukraine, we've got the Ukrainian Catholic Church producing this.
Yes, for those listening in audio only, this is a fresco on the wall of a uniate, which is an Eastern Rite Roman Catholic Church in Ukraine. Most of the population in Western Ukraine belongs to it, and they're in communion with the Vatican. And they've got a fresco here on the wall, which Ruptly, which is RT's soundbite or video bite sequence, has shown. And this is none other than Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin being licked by the flames of hell with a demon pointing at his side. Subtle message.
Yeah, and let's see, where are we now? So, and then the banks added as well. So the suggestions that Russia should be cut off from bank clearing. This has been rumbling in the background for quite a long time. Do you think this is starting to gain traction again?
It is. I mean, some quite important people there are tweeting it. John Schindler is warning about it here. But cutting Russia off from the banking industry is the equivalent of what Iran had done to it in the 90s. But people are very dependent on SWIFT now. Here on the continent, even if you buy something in a shop, or certainly if you make a cross-border postal order, you need SWIFT to make a bank transfer because they don't use credit cards nearly as much as Britain and America do. And so if you cut people off from SWIFT, you're preventing them from buying medicines and whatever else they need to order from abroad, and in some cases preventing them from drawing their salaries or sending support money to relatives. So that's very, very nasty. But I think Russia is catching up with it again, and we see a number of moves towards the an economic pillar within the Collective Security Treaty Organization and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So basically, Russia is doing an EU in its own Eurasian territory and getting together with China to form a new banking system. Who knows, sometime soon, maybe even a new currency. And if it's gold-backed, the dollar will be worthless and the euro with it.
And just to end off this Eastern European section, you wanted to highlight this article from 2015 about Russi.
Yes, it's well worth reading. As Russi welcomes a Nazi, RUSI is the Royal United Services Institute. As Russi welcomes a Nazi, which refers to Ukraine, should we be surprised? Well worth a read because they point out what you were saying a few days ago, that with David Petraeus and other such people on the board, they're far from independence. They are the think tank arm of the Anglo-American military juggernaut, shall we say. And someone's worked that out just even a couple of years ago. I should point out that someone in the chat room has helpfully reminded us the city of Gdansk I mentioned, which is the port that the American servicemen should be sailing into, is none other than pre-war Danzig. So we're back to 1939 again.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, look, I mentioned this 2 days ago, I think, Michael Fallon's comments about Russia and nuclear weapons in this country. And the quote was, in the most extreme circumstances, we, Britain, have made it clear that you can't rule out the use of nuclear weapons as a first strike. And I think in the chat box, Alex, or it was either you or David Ellis had said, well, actually, we don't have a first strike capability. But that's not the point. It's the rhetoric that's being used here. Of course, he said that they are better not. So he was asked what circumstances we would use our nuclear weapons as a first strike. He said they're better not specified or described. And he said the whole point about the deterrent is that you've got to leave uncertainty in the mind of anyone who might be thinking of using weapons against that country. Now, on couple of days ago, when we covered this, I said, well, actually, it's not uncertainty you need, it's certainty. It's certainty that you're going to use the weapons. The Russians are in fact have responded to this, and they're not leaving anything in doubt whatsoever. So here is Franz Klintsev. Is that how you pronounce his name? Klintsevich?
Klintsevich. Yeah, okay. Senator Klintsevich.
And he has said, the statement made by the UK's Defence Minister, Michael Fallon, calls for a harsh response. I'm not afraid of going too far. At best, this statement may be seen as an element of psychological war, which looks especially revolting in this context. There's quite a natural question then, what country could be primitively targeted by the UK? And of course, Russia is the answer to that. And he went on to say, the UK, which doesn't have a vast territory, will literally be wiped off from the face of the earth with a counterstrike. Not leaving anybody in any doubt, Alex?
No, exactly. In that translation, the Independent quoted both translations. They're both fairly good. In one translation, he's saying that Fallon is disgusting and the UK will be razed to the ground. And in the other one, which you quoted there, he's saying that Fallon's words are revolting and the UK will cease to exist, basically, whatever it was you just read out. Senator Klintsevich is an independent man. He's from a small local party. He's a perfect example of what senates, Russian case, they call them the Federation Council, precisely what they're supposed to do. He's a former paratrooper and linguist from the Afghan war period, and effectively he started off life as a primary school teacher out in the sticks in Belarus, precisely the kind of person who in the past would have been made a life peer for services to the nation in Britain, but is now being choked out by party appointees and public service hacks, third sector types. And Klintsevich has come in there, so he's the equivalent of, could we say, the opposition number two, on the Defence Committee in the House of Lords, because by convention you have one party chairing and the other party vice chairing. He's the vice chair from the non-governing party of the Senate Defence Committee, and he's in a perfect position as an old serviceman to say this is ridiculous language. The British are just using psychological warfare against us. We have a diminishing number of people, ex-servicemen in the Lords, who have got that kind of calibre and gumption.
I just wanted to remind people, really, this remarkable bit that Michael Fallon, where does he start off in his business career, building a mini empire out of children's nurseries? And I find this fascinating, that we have a grown man whose interest in small children, not the career of a lot of men, but he's interested in that. And of course, it's making profit out of those children's nurseries. And then the next minute, he's put in charge of defence and he's standing on the world stage threatening other nation states with nuclear weapons. This, to me, is an extremely, extremely dangerous personality. And we haven't yet really got into what it is that goes on inside Michael Fallon's head. But from children's nurseries to threatening Russia with nuclear weapons, this is an unbelievably dangerous man.
Yes, I'll just add on that the worst of the Labour defence secretaries was Jeff Hoon, variously known as the goon and so on in civil service parlance. And even Fallon, even by that standards, Fallon takes the biscuit. I remember I was in a conference with MOD counterparts, must be 11 years ago or so now, and Hoon had just cleared out of the MOD at that point, and we were using the conference suite, which had been his private office before they'd had a refurb. And I reached into a cupboard to get a tea bag out, and someone said, watch out for the arsenic. So that was how the civil service thought about Jeff Hoon, and I think that's how they think about Fallon is going to be even worse.
Yeah. Well, let's bring Ban Ki-moon in, of course, former UN Secretary General. He was speaking at the Harvard Kennedy School in Massachusetts. He said that the world is moving closer to nuclear annihilation. He said it's truly frightening. He said the situation on the Korean Peninsula is alarming. Never in the past have we seen such a heightened tension on the Korean Peninsula, not since the Korean War. Well, here we go. The US has now begun installing missile defense equipment. The protests, I'm not seeing too much being reported in the Western media about the protests going on in Korea over this. Koreans do not want this in their country, and China doesn't want this in Korea either, because they believe it destabilizes the entire situation. Alex, what are your thoughts on this situation?
Korea, China, US is a very complicated triangle. I'd recommend people watch the new video which Stefan Molyneux just put up with a Korea expert, which is called The Horrible Truth About North Korea, just a few days ago. Molyneux is very well known on YouTube, so you'll find him without difficulty. That's just one of many accessible but scholarly presentations in which you'll hear that we created the North Korea situation in the 1950s by deliberately letting the communist regime stay in the northern half of the country. And since then, it's basically been the geopolitical sink. If there's been insufficient tension in the Middle East or Eastern Europe to maintain the aggravating posture which the Western military financial industrial complex needs in order to prop up the currencies, then North Korea, South Korea is the potential war zone which has been ramped up to meet demand, much like Qatar and Iran act as a gas sink by stepping up demand when Russia is slack and vice versa. So it's a question of keeping up the threat to, you know, within a certain parameters, upper and lower thresholds, in order to keep the system stable, because too little tension and the system will fall over and a lot of people will be severely out of pocket.
Okay, well, let's move back to Russia then. And you wanted to, we're describing this as Gladio B, I suppose, but this first video from RT on this tweet here, Central Asian Turks being unleashed in Moscow.
Yes, this is the St. Petersburg metro bombing. And it's, in this case, southern Kyrgyz who have been responsible. But in other cases, in recent attacks, we have seen people from neighboring parts of Central Asia, so Chinese Uyghurs responsible or Uzbeks. And in this case, it looks like the guy is having his face smashed by Russian counter-terrorist police. But if you watch the clip, you'll see, and I don't see how this could possibly have been staged, that they basically force his face like that into the side of the van in order to pull desperately at a kind of, well, they're usually called bum bags or fanny packs, aren't they? One of these sort of waist-level pouches. And they unzip that, and there is a grenade in the pouch. And this was on the streets of St. Petersburg. There's been more body cam footage like this. And if the Russians didn't put the body cams on the FSB officers, we would be hearing what we heard last decade when there was a spate of bombings across Russia, which is the Russians being brutal. Here's the second still from a separate incident. That was the brother of the mastermind. This is the mastermind now. And in this body cam, you will see, I've tweeted these, by the way, if you want to follow where they are, you will see the FSB go and pin this guy down to the ground. And again, Kyrgyz features, and he gives his name as Azimov, classic Central Asian name. So, yes, OK, there's a lot of Central Asian illegal immigrants and migrant labor in Moscow, probably a million undeclared people in Greater Moscow of that region. But in this case, we see that they seem to have been reactivated for the first time since a decade. So, again, Gladio B is the same kind of deal as Korea. You know, if tensions are not at the desired level in the Middle East and Eastern Europe, the world's premier hotspots on demand, then you can always ramp up anti-Russian terrorism within Russia.
But not just in Russia.
No, and look at this. You know, people are getting a bit more au fait in the West with how the garb differs from one part of the Muslim world to another. And Mike, you showed recently a guy in Syria striding around with a rifle and a shalwar kameez, which is Pashtun garb worn in the Afghan and Pakistani highlands. And there we've got a guy with absolutely classic Central Asian beard and features and cap, apparently volunteering in the Free Syrian Army. And this was tweeted out by an independent MP from Aleppo, Fariz Shahabi, who's well worth following, by the way, and reading, because he specializes in taking apart how Erdogan and Turkish mercenaries have stolen every bit of industrial equipment from Aleppo, which used to be the Middle East's premier industrial base, and have taken all the stuff off to Turkey, much like the Germans did from Belgium after World War One.
So who do you think is actually on the ground in these regions encouraging these people into Russia and into Syria?
Well, it doesn't take many on the ground, and Gladio B is still a mystery. And, you know, if I, in all modesty, if I've barely worked it out after being in the responsible section in the intelligence services for nearly a decade, then there must be very tight compartments. And what the sense I get from the dribs and drabs I have pieced together over the years is you only need a very few XMI6 and XSAS type dark side actors. And once you've installed a few of them in the nearest capital city or safe place with a cafe facility, then you just need a few runners to act as the go-betweens between them and the Gladio operatives themselves, the Central Asians, or in the previous wave in Gladio A, it was fake communists and fake fascists in European youth movements. So it really only perhaps 100 men need to be involved at the upper echelon.
So you've hinted at British involvement in that. Is that how you see it?
Not one of these episodes has ever been seen over the decades that didn't have MI6, or I should be specific, didn't have a high-up ex-MI6 evil operative in it. You know, MI6 is also part of the solution, because a lot of their officers have got fantastic knowledge of how to report and fish out this kind of activity, but they're not being supported in doing so.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Alex. We'll leave that section there then. And just a quick reminder, tomorrow night, Thursday, 27th of April, between 7 and 10, we have Vaxxed being shown in West London, the venue to be confirmed tomorrow. If you want to get involved in that, keep your eye on this Facebook group, Bring Vaxxed to the UK.
Okay, and we'll add to that. Didn't pick it up yesterday, but this was on a tweet that came through this morning while we were preparing the news. Here we are, World Immunisation Week, and some remarkable claims by the UN. Vaccines prevent everything, and in fact, they limit the spread of antibiotic resistance. I didn't have time to get detail, but I've just put here no factual evidence to support these claims. There they are. Okay, well, we'd like to remind people that we've got Ian Crane's Aviate coming up on the 21st of May. Tickets are still available, and I know that Ian will be keen that he's got a full audience. So if you've never been to an AV before, alternative view before, then do go along, because you will meet some very, very interesting people. It is always fun, and of course, some really good speakers. And we're also going to remind people that the British Constitution Moot in Nottingham, a really fantastic event in itself. People at that event have pledged us a monthly sum. We've been completely open and say, to get the initiative driving forward, we need more money coming in on a monthly basis. If you're able to do a monthly donation, we've suggested £5. You can now do that through the website. Thanks to Mike. Well, let's just remind people that many years ago, I think this must take us back about 4 or 5 years, one of the UK column viewers did this fantastic cartoon showing the chaos which is unleashed on the population of UK. But above the shadowy clouds of propaganda and the BBC and what he described as the Lib Lab Con fifth column, it was, of course, the bankers ultimately controlling the show. And I think that situation is very much the case. And you're going to take us to RBS here, I think, Mike.
Well, I mean, it's a smaller story. West. It's NatWest. It is RBS, NatWest, RBS, same company. But I've noticed, according to this, that my daughter's Young Savers account, which was attached to my NatWest accounts, had disappeared from my online banking page. On calling the bank, I was told the account didn't exist. Luckily, I managed to dig out an old statement, at which point NatWest agreed that it had existed, but it had been closed due to inactivity. There was £3,161 in the account. They just closed the account due to inactivity and taken the money. And she's basically asking, you know, do these banks not have enough money of their own that they need to take money like this? And of course, the answer is no, they don't have enough money of their own. They steal every penny they can get. Now, of course, if that account had remained dormant for 15 years, and of course, if the bank is just removing it from their lists, because the other point that she makes in this is that when she called the call centre, that she discovered that the call centre had no knowledge of it because the bank removes it from the call centre's list, even though it's only a dormant account. If that had been just dropped off somebody's radar, that would have become, after 15 years, the property of the government to use as they see fit. Now, the government, of course, claims that if you attempt to recover that money, you can have it back. But in fact, what they're doing with it is using it to fund the big society.
Right. OK, so let's remember the first part of our news today is very much the tension overseas, the growing clamour for war and violence to achieve, obviously, a clear geopolitical aim in the Middle East. But all of this acts as a beautiful smokescreen for what's going on at home, including with the banks. But brace yourselves, because we're going to say well done to a Guardian journalist. And the lady is Holly Watt. And she did a big read. And what was that about? Sorry, the long read it's called, How the MOD's Plan to Privatise Military Housing Ended in Disaster. Credit where it's due. This is a really excellent piece of investigative journalism. With one small but, she doesn't take it far enough. But let's capture what she reported. So here's her article. Here's, of course, the Ministry of Defence. And what did they do? They sold 57,400 MOD properties for $1.67 billion to this company, Annington Homes. And within no time at all, those properties became worth $6.7 billion. And MOD rented the properties back, a mere 39,000 houses rented back, for a mere $167 million per annum. There was a cap on the rental, the back rental, which is shortly going to be removed, which means that that $167 million is going to have a massive hike. Who benefits? Well, it's individuals like this man, former US Goldman Sachs bond trader Guy Hans, who's one of the key elements of this company. So public infrastructure, Mike, belongs to the public. The public ultimately have paid for, is given away to bankers. They then make a huge profit, and then they rape the public purse again by charging the public money to use what is theirs in the first place. So well done to that lady. Do go and read the article, but perhaps you'd also be kind enough to maybe email or give us some tweets to say what you need to realise is this is happening right the way across the public property portfolio. And as Mike Robinson has discovered, when you ask the Treasury how many properties, how much, what the value is across the whole giveaway of public property, the Treasury says, well, we don't really keep accounts. Well, the other thing we've got happening is a drought. And I have to smile here because Mrs. Gerrish was getting very concerned at the state of our lawn. Of course, here in Devon, at least, we've had quite a few weeks now with no real rain at all. So express hosepipe ban coming. Britain braced for shock new rules. So there's more pressure. And in the article, I loved this, a wonderful diagram of the groundwater system. And as I looked at it, it reminded me, of course, of all the good work that Ian Crane has been doing, pointing out that our groundwater resource is immensely valuable. And the dangers of what happens when we put a fracking machine in. So if you're not up to speed on what fracking does, it poisons the groundwater supply, the very supply which the government says we now need to protect. But I also noticed this. There was a name down in the corner of this image. And in fact, the organisation is mentioned in the article itself. And who is it? Well, it's Affinity Water. And I was fascinated because I'd never heard of Affinity Water before, and I like to go looking at things. So let's share our research. Here they are. Now, they are looking after some 900 million litres of water, I think. But they're a very interesting organisation. Let's look at who's running them. We've got InfraCapital, that's European Infrastructure Funds. Managed by M&G Investments, which is ultimately a subsidiary of Prudential. We've got a partners group, which is Global Private Markets. That's US companies and also elements registered in Guernsey. Viola Water, which is a subsidiary of Environment South Africa. We've got this one, Morgan Stanley Global Infrastructure Investment Limited. And the final one here, Beryl Datura Investment Limited, and established by the State Administration of the Foreign Exchange of the People's Republic of China. Now, I've got a little bit more on this, but if I may, we'll say to you, Alex, I'm puzzled about this because on one hand, we've got a basic need, Britain's water being given away to foreign investment. But I thought China was an enemy. I always have problems with this because we've got newspaper articles about Chinese aircraft carriers and we're very worried. But we're quite happy if China is going to run our strategic infrastructure.
Water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink, wrote Samuel Taylor Coleridge in The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And that's the situation Britain is in now. My grandfather always used to say, Britain will never starve or freeze because we're on an island sitting on coal and surrounded by fish. And now we have neither coal nor fish to our name. And apparently our water's not our own either. Scottish water has been apparently sold off to English companies by the SNP, very Scottish nationalist of them. And more generally, if you look at the series bar at the top of the UK Column website or on a mobile device, the three lines on the top left, you will see there that there's a series called One World Governance. And the bottom three articles at the moment, they're being expanded by a Dutch lady, Bernice Bartels. And in one of them, she writes that access to water is one of the things for which we're going to have barcoded, implanted equipment or access tokens in future, basically body specific. And so instead of being taxed for our utilities, as it were, the idea in future is we'll have them as a munificence of the local government. But if we don't have the chip or if we fall out of favour by expressing the wrong opinions, we may lose our access. And for that, we need a closed system and an artificial shortage. As regards military housing, I'll just mention that a decade ago, I noticed that a lot of the servicemen drafted to GCHQ and posted there were living at the former RAF base at Innsworth down the road near Gloucester. And those houses were deliberately being run down, I think, prior to this policy, to the extent that servicemen were complaining that it wasn't safe to leave their wives and children in those houses because the local tykes had got wind of the fact that every third house was boarded up. And so they were just going and playing merry hell, even in the daytime, in those RAF bases that were being run down. So I think the idea was to hit bottom dollar before sale.
Absolutely.
But we're getting the lid off this. And of course, when we get back to the sell-off of everything, it's the bankers, the banksters at the back of it. But we've also got an ideology which is eating into society, the civil service and our politicians. What better place to go is common purpose. And I'm going to smile because I'm going to say thank you to one of our viewers who just said, have you seen this? Now, I'll come into what triggered them originally, but I went to look at common purpose students. Here's the glossy image. We're uniting students across the world. Doesn't matter what your nationality is, we are helping you. And I found this amazing little clip in there where this young girl is holding up this sign. And what does it say? I need cultural intelligence to understand my true identity. This will help myself understand about my background and the true self of me. This is just massive, massive reframing and dangerous reframing of young minds. And the girl is spelling it out. It couldn't be clearer, Mike, that this pernicious charity, which of course is totally supported by the Labour Party, Lib Dems and the Conservatives, driving for this globalisation by directly attacking people's minds. What triggered the person on this? Well, they had a little look at accounts, and apparently here on the official government website, this organisation is well overdue for accounts. So another indication of how trustworthy Common Purpose is. But we'd like to remind people, of course, that very vicious abusers of women and paedophiles embedded in the Common Purpose structure. And we've never forgotten this man, Matthew Byrne, pictured here alongside David Cameron with Michael Heseltine. They were giving him an award. Never any full investigation into who he recruited or what networks he set up inside Common Purpose.
Yes, because he was on the advisory group which was selecting future Common Purpose members.
Future Common Purpose leaders, Mike. These are the types of leaders that Common Purpose was happy to have in their ranks. And when, of course, we pointed out this, they got extremely aggressive with us. Alex, I'm just going to say this business of the control of language and the use of the British government of applied behavioural psychology to drive its political agenda, in my opinion, is the most dangerous threat we face, because you cannot reason with people who've been heavily reframed in this way.
Well, Brian, we've seen a history of mumbo jumbo through the 20th century in the West, particularly the English speaking countries. And we are perhaps a bit more inured to it, but it hits like a bomb in these Asian societies where Common Purpose is now going in, because they have deep philosophical and language based ideas of the self. I mean, we're used now to the idea of, you know, gurus saying every day in every way it's getting better and better. Or I think it was Barbara Streisand, the popstrel 50 years ago. She shocked people by standing on a beach in California and saying, I am God. You know, but that, we're used to that. It seeps into our culture now. But when it hits India, China, Africa, where you know they're very concerned with the use of language to understand who you are in society, it's going to wreak a lot more havoc a lot more quickly.
Okay, and just to add to the this culture of the behavioural reframing, this was sent to me. If you just pop this one up on the screen, thank you, Mike. We've got Deputy Chief Constable Andy Rhodes. He's on. I'm sorry, I can't think what the organisation. It's a podcast. He's talking about well-being, and apparently he is the well-being guru for the police. He's had his own problems, I believe, some mild mental breakdown of some sort. He's then become a leader. He's into wellness, and you can listen to him talking about how the police are going to help its own police members who've had problems with trauma. But his language, I find deeply concerning because he's using all of the catchphrases. Will he be helping John Wedger, the policeman who spoke out about the cover-up of child abuse in London? And that police force, far from nurturing John and looking after him, brutally attacking him and then also attacking him whilst his son has been in intensive care. So we wonder whether people might challenge that police officer. If I just bring him back on screen, here he is. Lancashire Police, I think, but it's okay. Maybe you can get in contact with this man and ask whether he's going to help John Wedger. And of course, John Wedger trying to protect children. This leads us on to this remarkable interview, which I have seen, but you're going to just take us through with a Dutch banker here talking about what he was essentially asked to do.
Yes, if you look up this video, there's many copies of it, but the original, which has got comments disabled, is called Pizzagate, Pedogate, Dutch Whistleblower, Real Big Money Revelations by an Insider. Or if you just type into YouTube Dutch Whistleblower, you'll probably get it at the moment because it's so viral. And this is a guy called Ronald Bernard. People are wrong to point out underneath that he was an ex-Merrill Lynch man. That's a separate American. This chap is Dutch, and he's been in some kind of cooperative to build a new economy for years since he had this crisis moment. But what he's telling the Dutch interviewer, it's very, very well subtitled. Some people have said, can we trust the subtitles? Absolutely, you can. He's talking about how he was a banker for the elite and proud of his position, and his body language completely changes, and he's got tears welling up. He's trying to swallow them at this point, and he's saying, I was invited when I got successful to go and start regularly. The Dutch is more explicit than English. He says, I was invited to become one of those who regularly sacrifice children on behalf of the Luciferians who run the banks. And he said, I couldn't manage that. My conscience couldn't allow it. So he said, they tried to get me to be the phrase he uses is put my conscience in the freezer to do my work. And when it came to sacrificing children, I couldn't do it. His body language is utterly sincere. And I think there's very little doubt that he's telling us the truth about what happened to him. To my knowledge, it's the first time that a banker has said actually explicitly, A, high bankers enjoy sacrificing children, and B, high bankers are mostly Luciferian in religion.
Okay, thank you very much for taking us through the analysis of Russia, but also that last one. We're really getting into the meat of things when we know that the people who control the international money system are capable of this sort of thing. And of course, these are the very banksters who are capable of controlling international politicians to push whatever agenda they want through the system. I think we're going to see a lot more information and evidence about this level of operation coming to the surface, and clearly we're getting more whistleblowers prepared to talk. Must have taken a lot of courage for this man to speak. So if you haven't seen that video, get online and have a look, because it makes you think. And if there is anyone out there who says, well, this is just not possible that people should indulge in this sort of behaviour, then you need to look to the UK column interview with satanic ritual abuse survivor Vicky Ash, because she's one of many, many people who can testify about the brutal reality of this type of belief system. Well, we'll end on that unhappy note. We'll just give a reminder to people that we were given some donations for John Wedger at the British Constitution Group event. I've spoken to him today, and we're going to attempt to get that money through to him. But he has had a very difficult time because the police have alternatively stopped his pay altogether or put him on half pay, with many other pressures. And I say he's been very hard pressed over recent months because his son has been very, very seriously ill in intensive care. I'm pleased to say today there's signs of a recovery, but what a brutal system of Cressida Dix Met Police that she uses her own police officers to harass a police officer prepared to whistleblow on those covering up the abuse of children. Welcome to Theresa May, Amber Rudd's Britain in 2017. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye.